From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, with a state tax incentives package on the line, Dan Gilbert's team stepped up political donations.
Employees who work for either Quicken Loans or Rock Ventures have increased the number of campaign contributions they're handing out.
How the Ilitches financed Little Caesars Arena even as Detroit wrestled with bankruptcy.
If Detroit had a modern, sophisticated downtown development plan, they might have been able to extract more concessions, get more revenue.
How one man left a lasting taint of the Ku Klux Klan on Livingston County.
And in the 1970s and 80s and right up until his death 25 years ago, he held big cross burnings and hate rallies at his farm in Cahokta Township.
Those stories and more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Little Caesars Arena officially opens today. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk about how the Ilitches were able to finance a new home for the Detroit Red Wings in a bankrupt city. But first, state lawmakers headed back to Lansing last week to launch the fall session. Let's look at what the legislative priorities are for Michigan's House. With us now, House Speaker Tom Leonard, Republican from DeWitt. Mr. Speaker, welcome back to the program.
Hey, thank you very much for having me, Cynthia. I'm happy to be here.
Let's start with auto insurance. You and other House Republican leaders have been in conversations with Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan about ways to lower auto insurance premiums. And you can hear an amen from almost every corner of Michigan, but especially Detroit. And one of the main components you were talking about was a guaranteed rate rollback. Last week, your counterpart in the Senate Majority Leader, Arlen Meekhoff, said he wouldn't support any plan that would force insurers to reduce rates. He calls it price fixing. What are your thoughts?
Well, let me say this. You know, I can only control what happens in the House. I can't control what happens in the Senate. But at the end of the day, we have got to see rate relief for the hardworking citizens of the state. I mean, everywhere I go, this has become a top issue for many, many people. And as you mentioned, it is not just a Detroit thing. And the mayor and I talked about this a couple years ago when he was looking at the de-insurance or a Detroit solution, if you will. And I told him, I said, Mayor, this has got to be a statewide solution. Everywhere I go, it doesn't matter if I'm in the Upper Peninsula, doesn't matter if I'm in Hillsdale, doesn't matter if I'm in Grand Rapids. This is a big issue for a lot of folks, and they need to see rate relief. So, again, I can only control what happens in the House, but I'll also say this as well. We've got a rigged auto insurance system that forces our consumers to purchase an unlimited lifetime liability with absolutely zero cost control. I mean, if we want to talk about free market and choice, I would say that the system we have is the complete opposite of that. So we need to look at rate relief, and that's where we're headed.
Do you consider rate rollbacks price fixing?
What I look at this is as fixing a rigged system. Again, we've got a system right now where people have absolutely no choice. They are forced to purchase an unlimited lifetime liability with absolutely no cost control or cost containment in the system. So I want to look at doing whatever we can do to bring all sides to the table so that our citizens can see serious rate relief when they get their premiums next year.
Now, the insurance industry has been pushing this optional approach where drivers can choose a cap on benefits in exchange for lower rates. How much support to this optional approach do you think is in the House?
Well, we will have to see, and that's a conversation we are going to have. You know, another issue I've talked to the mayor about, and he understands this, is at the end of the day, this is more than likely going to have to be a bipartisan solution. I don't believe the votes are there on either side of the aisle, 55, if you will, from one party. So this is going to have to be a bipartisan solution. It's going to take everybody coming to the table. But again, at the end of the day, I think or I know rate relief has to be our top priority. It can't be about a giveaway to the insurance companies. It can't be about a giveaway to the provider network. We've got to stay focused on the consumer, and that's what I hope this plan will do.
Speaker Leonard, when you do a temperature check with members on both sides of the aisle, do you get a sense that the appetite and the willingness is there to come to a bipartisan approach?
We will see how it goes. I am really counting on the mayor to be able to deliver Democrat votes here. I know he is working diligently around the clock to do this. I will tell you, for the first time in 5 years, I've had several Democrats on the other side of the aisle have come to me and said they are seriously listening to this proposal. They are considering it. So you know, I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm hoping we can get there. And I got to tell you, I've even got members of my own caucus who have never really been there on insurance reform who are really listening now, because when you start talking about serious rate relief for the citizens of this state, it really gets people listening.
What of local government pension reforms? What do you see moving on that front?
That is something I look forward to meeting with the governor and the Senate Majority Leader very soon. The governor just wrapped up his work group, if you will, and I know they just put together everything. So we will be meeting very soon. One thing I do know is this, and I think we have all agreed upon, is every local government is different. Some are in very, very bad shape when it comes to their pensions and their OPEB liabilities, whereas others, like where I live in Clinton County, they've done a phenomenal job. I believe they're 98% funded. So whatever solution we look at, it can't be a one-size-fits-all approach. You know, we're going to have to address the worst of the worst, if you will.
Because if you think about roadblocks, where do you see those? Because the whole issue of pension reforms kind of lost momentum when it was time to push it over the finish line earlier this year.
Yeah, well, I know this. That was a problem in lame duck last year. And I remember meeting with, you know, the police unions, the fire unions, the local units of government when we put the brakes on the legislation in lame duck last year. And you know, the one thing I will say that everybody did acknowledge is that there's a problem. I mean, when you look at here in mid-Michigan, you look at the city of Lansing, and my numbers might be just a tad off here, but I think their health care liabilities are $450 million, and I think they're only 14% funded. I mean, I have spoken to local Lansing retirees and police officers and firefighters, and even though some of them may not want to see reform, they understand that there's a problem and it's got to be solved. So again, I look forward to having this discussion when we come back. No legislation's been written yet. We'll see where the governor wants to head. We'll see if the Senate has an appetite to take this up, but it's certainly an issue we've got to have the conversation and we've got to address soon.
I'm speaking with Michigan's House Speaker Tom Leonard, and let's go over to education. The Federal Department of Education rejected Michigan's School Accountability Plan because it doesn't have an A through F grading system. Can you see a way clear to revisiting that?
This is an issue that I certainly look forward to sitting down and talking with our education chair, Tim Kelly, about. I have not had an opportunity to chat with him yet, have not had an opportunity to review that report. One thing we do know is that when taxpayer dollars are being spent, schools need to be held accountable anytime taxpayer dollars are involved, whether that be a public school or whether that be a charter school. So we certainly have to have accountability standards, but I also know on the flip side of that, there are privacy concerns and other concerns. So I look forward to having that conversation and making certain that we've got a students oriented approach, if you will.
It's very clear, Speaker Leonard, your wish list includes reforming delivery of mental health services in Michigan. You appointed a task force that has been holding public hearings across the state. What have you learned?
What I have learned is that this is a very big problem. And, you know, I've been clear to the folks that I've spoken with. I said I would much rather under-promise and over-deliver versus over-promising and under-delivering. And at the end of the day, I feel we can make some very substantial progress, but it very well may be just a few raindrops in the ocean compared to what we actually have to do to fix this system. But I am very proud of the task force that has been going around from you know, county to county, city to city. We've got 7 Republicans, 7 Democrats. And, you know, another thing that I have learned is just how big of an issue this is to real people. We've been having these town halls, or the work group has been. And we thought maybe 15, 20 people would show up. We've got packed houses showing up, wanting to help, wanting to address this issue. This is an issue that affects every Michigander. They've got close friends, family members that have suffered from mental illness. And I look forward to delivering real results for them this fall.
Where would you start?
Well, again, good question. We are collecting the information right now. The work group is on a listening tour, if you will, to find out how best to address this. But what we've got to look at doing is the best way to connect individuals to services. When you look at our corrections budget, a $2 billion budget where nearly a quarter to a third of our prison population suffers from some type of mental illness. And after somebody has committed a heinous crime, you can give them all the help you want, but it's too late at that point. The damage has already been done. So what we need to do is find better ways to diagnose folks, but also when they have been diagnosed, connect them to services so that they're not out there committing these heinous crimes, finding themselves in prison for decades on end.
Another issue before the legislature is whether to override Governor Snyder's veto of a bill that would accelerate the phase out of applying the sales tax to the value of a trade-in when we buy a vehicle. I know it starts in the Senate. Do you think the Senate should vote to override the veto? And then do you think the House would follow suit?
Well, that is a good question. That's one you'd have to ask Senator Meekhoff. I've been very clear about this. I do believe it's the right policy. You know, the auto industry is a huge, it's a huge deal for our state. I personally do support overriding the veto. But again, it's going to have to start in the Senate. And then if the Senate decides to take it up and if they do override the governor, once it gets to the House, I will have that conversation with my caucus. And if they choose to go that route, then we will do it. But as for me personally, I'm fully supportive of doing that.
How would you characterize your relationship with the governor heading into this term?
Oh, I would say it's very good. We have worked very well together over the past 8 or 9 months. We've gotten some good things done. I mean, you look at Lansing. Lansing is not like D.C. It's not broken. We got our budget done 4 or 5 months in advance. We finally all came to the table and addressed our broken teacher retirement system. The governor has been, I will just say he has been strongly listening on the no-fault issue. I know that's a big issue for him, and he's all in trying to help us with mental health as well. So the governor and I are right there together on some of our state's biggest issues, and I look forward to working with him over the next 15 months as we tackle them.
House Speaker Tom Leonard, we want to thank you for taking time to be with us today on Stateside.
Hey, thank you so much, Cynthia. Appreciate it.
You're listening to Stateside. If you miss any part of today's show, it's very easy to find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org and click on podcast and you'll find the link. Still to come, why is Livingston County considered the KKK capital of Michigan?
It's sort of the type of thing that once that kind of a reputation starts, it's really hard to kill it.
We will answer another Am I Curious question. That's in 10 minutes here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's time to check on the newest offerings from professional theater companies around the state. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is back with us, and we're going to start by heading back to the 60s.
Yeah, the first up this week is a terrific, funny farce play called Boeing Boeing, which opens up at the Tipping Point in Northville. Plays a bit of a throwback. It began in France in the 60s and is about a bachelor who's balancing his dalliances with three different flight attendants. And he usually does a good job of keeping them from meeting each other on the threshold of his apartment because they're on different flight routes. But the funny part of the story, the wheels come off this whole arrangement, and the whole thing becomes a comedic farce with the gals all ending up in town at the same time. Plus his nerdy friend from high school who is visiting him and who becomes a player in all the action.
And I recall this was a Tony Curtis, Jerry Lewis film in 1965, which we can see who played the pilot and who was the nerdy friend. Now, you talked with the Tipping Point director, Dave Davies.
Right. He's a terrific actor, and also he directed this. And he talked a bit about how a play like this holds up.
It's Boeing Boeing is typical French farce. But it was written in 1960, and like any classic play, if you look at it through modern eyes, there's typically a modern spin you can put on it. So while our story does take place in 1965, as far as the comedy goes, does have a much more modern spin on it, a modern take on it.
Well, that's, you know, hey, people love Mad Men. And not that was a comedy, but we are ready to, you know, we get it that this was 50 years ago. But if it still makes you laugh, laughter is good.
Yes. And then we have a complete kind of gear change here. It's a much different kind of play. Return to some Detroit history, if you will, a play called Strawberry, What a Party. And it's a play about the death of Tamara Green, who was an exotic dancer who many, including the play's author, believe was killed by associates of former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that was a news story, and it's really urban lore, and it's persisted in Detroit since 2003. So even though official investigation says it didn't happen, many believe that Tamara Green danced for then-Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick at an alleged wild party at the Manoogian Mansion. Again, the word alleged. And that Detroit's First Lady Carlita Kilpatrick walked in and allegedly beat Green in the middle of giving a lap dance to the mayor. A few months later, in April 2003, Tamara Green was killed in a drive-by shooting, and the bullets that killed her reportedly came from a .40-caliber pistol, which we should note was standard issue for the Detroit Police Department. And more than 14 years later, her murder remains unsolved. So no one's been able to, A, prove the party happened, and B, who killed Tamara. There are people that think a hit might have been ordered on her to keep her from being a huge political embarrassment for Kwame Kilpatrick, who, of course, is now serving 28 years in a federal prison in Oklahoma for public corruption. But so this story has been turned into what kind of play? How's it constructed?
Well, Carol Teagarden, who is a former Detroit Free Press reporter, wrote this play. It premiered in Detroit last year, kind of a workshop situation, but now she's updated it a bit. There are cast changes, and it's being performed at the Adre Auditorium in Dearborn. And Teagarden also wrote a book on this investigation, on which the play is based, called Strawberry, How an Exotic Dancer Toppled Detroit's Hip-Hop Mayor. The play, which I saw last year, I have not seen this new iteration yet, I'm going to, is... It's well done. I mean, it's structured. You have the police in, you know, characters there. The investigators, of course, you have Tamara's character. I really liked it. And I thought it was a very good window into a chapter of Detroit history.
An alleged chapter.
An alleged chapter,
indeed,
yes.
Indeed. And now to the University Musical Society. And they've got a show timed to National Suicide Prevention Week.
That's right. It's called Every Brilliant Thing. And it's a one-man show. And it's really this character kind of ruminating and talking, at times talking with the audience, about whether or not he should kill himself, whether his life is worth going forward with. Now, it is not the colossal bummer that may sound
Yeah,
like.
You say don't be sheepish about this.
Yeah, it's actually a really interesting piece. It's funny at times. It's poignant. And it's very provocative and thought-provoking. It is not a night of bummer.
Every Brilliant Thing at the University Musical Society. Now, you recently held the 2017 Wild Awards, basically the Michigan Tonys. Tell us about the three big award getters.
The three big ones were The Barn in Augusta, and they won multiple awards for a really over-the-top production of The Little Mermaid because the acting and the singing and their set design was just so over-the-top great that they won multiple awards for that. The Williamston Theater won multiple awards as well, not for musicals, but for their plays 1984 and Pulp. 1984, of course, based on the George Orwell book that has had a surge in popularity, the book sales through Amazon and,
yes,
and now this play. And Pulp, a play which is written by Michigan playwright Joe Zettelmeyer, who we've had on this segment before.
Mm-hmm.
And the Encore Musical Theater in Dexter, which was also a big winner for its productions of Assassins, and the Full Monty.
Oh, very good. Yeah. Very good. And then you want to talk a little about this year's Rising Star. So this is what, best performance by an actor under the age of 18?
Correct. This is the second year we've had this award. And it was won by an actor working at the Slipstream Initiative Theater in Ferndale. His name is Jackson Obahasira, who turned in a remarkable performance as a trans woman who's put into a reality show in which she is supposed to compete in a contest called Pretty Young Girl. It's the Pretty Young Girl contest. The name of the play was PYG, and the whole thing is an update on the Pygmalion story.
Interesting.
That's what Slipstream does mostly. They do updates of classics. Jackson's performance was extraordinary for such a young actor, and he gave a wonderful speech at the awards ceremony, standing up for the rights of transgender people and LGBTQ. And we spoke with Jackson this week about how he attacked this role and this opportunity.
We constantly met with the playwright to add changes and revisions as we saw through our conferences with the transgender woman who helped us on the journey and some of the other people that some interviews that we had watched and documentaries and things just to make sure that it was never cartoonish or stereotypical in any way. And then we did a complete and whole physical transformation to the best of our abilities, including removal of all my body hair and all that fun stuff, just to make sure that it was never disingenuous to, you know, the actual struggles or times of being a transgender woman, especially in the modern era.
I can tell that you think we should keep our eye on Jackson.
Yes. You know, he was 17 when he did this role. Mm-hmm. And it's hard enough for young actors, you know, in high school to hold their own on a stage with adults and sometimes equity actors. And he was remarkable.
Exciting. Well, congratulations, Jackson. And thanks, as always, to David Kiley of Encore Michigan. You can go to EncoreMichigan.com and get all the details on these and other professional theater productions all around Michigan. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
What?
When?
Why?
I am curious.
Time for another round of Am I Curious? You pose the question, and we find the answer for you. The scenes of white supremacists marching in Charlottesville, including the Ku Klux Klan, led to this question from a Michigan radio listener.
My name is Zachary Jones. I'm from Ypsilanti, Michigan. And my question is, why is Livingston County considered the KKK capital of Michigan?
Here to answer Zachary's question is Buddy Morehouse. He's the former editor at the Livingston County Press in Howell. These days, he's a blogger for the Livingston Post. And Buddy, so glad to have you with us. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
Why does Livingston County, and particularly Howell, have this KKK aura?
Well, it is actually very easily explained. And it's important to say right at the beginning, though, that there is no KKK in Howell. Howell is not the headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan. There's no active chapter there. There's no active Ku Klux Klan anywhere in Livingston County. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks those things, they confirm that there is no KKK in Howell. But the reason why Howell has that reputation is actually very easily explained. And it's all because of one man who's been dead for 25 years now. Robert Miles was the Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan in Michigan. And he actually wasn't from Howell. He lived near Howell in a rural area called Cahock Township. And in the 1970s and 80s and right up until his death 25 years ago, he held big cross burnings and hate rallies at his farm in Cahockta Township. And it was because of that, and he was very open about this. He would invite the media to come to these cross burnings. He loved being in the newspaper. He loved being on the radio and having a microphone stuck in his face. Unlike a lot of other hate group leaders, Bob Miles loved publicity.
And why did he told you he loved it when you were the editor of the Livingston County Press. Why did he love the publicity?
He liked the fact that the media was helping keep alive this image that there was a Ku Klux Klan active in Livingston County, because he thought that if we helped keep that image alive, that it would help Livingston County remain an almost all-white community.
Mm.
So he liked the fact that we publicized what he did, and he was very open about inviting us there. But it's because of Bob Miles that Livingston County, and particularly Howell, got this reputation of being a KKK hotbed, even though this wasn't even taking place in Howell. Howell was just the closest city that anybody had heard of to Cahockta Township. So the media and everybody else started saying that all this was taking place near Howell, even though it wasn't even in Howell.
Why was Bob Miles, why did he have the title pastor in quotes?
He was I put pastor in quotes. He was the pastor of a church that he founded himself called the Mountain Church. It was basically in a pole barn on his property. On his farm there, and he called himself the pastor of the church. It was they had some crazy white separatist brand of Christianity that he was espousing there, and so he called himself the pastor of the church.
And did he have any other job beyond leading Michigan's Klan?
He grew up in New York City. He was originally from New York City. He moved to Livingston County sometime in the late 50s or early 60s, and he was an insurance executive.
Hmm. And besides talking hate and burning crosses on his farm and holding rallies, he actually committed actions that landed him in prison. Tell us about that.
Right, yeah. As I said in the piece I wrote for the Livingston Post on him, he didn't just think evil thoughts. He did evil things. In the early 1970s, he was convicted of two horrible crimes. He was convicted of conspiring to bomb school buses in Pontiac. That was around the time that integration was taking place with busing. And he conspired with some other people to bomb some school buses there. And the real horrific thing he did is in 1971, he helped, along with a few other Klansmen, he helped to tar and feather a high school principal from Ypsilanti, because this principal had the audacity to propose that Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday be a holiday.
Wow. And he did wind up in prison, but that didn't slow him down.
He served several years in prison for both of those crimes.
But he got out, and I gather from your post in the Livingston Post, it didn't slow him down.
No, not at all. That's really when he started to become a white supremacist icon. It was when he got out of prison in the late 70s that he started holding these huge hate rallies and cross burnings at his farm in Cahock Township. And that's really when his reputation started to grow, and that's really when Howell's unfair reputation as a hotbed of this activity started.
And is that pretty much when reporters and just about everyone else began thinking of Howell and Livingston County as Klan country, or did it even go back into the 70s?
It really started in the probably the late 70s, mm-hmm. maybe even in the into the early 80s, but it was mainly when he started becoming well-known for these crimes in the 70s and started giving interviews at his farm that he became known. And then when he got out of prison sometime in the late 70s is when he started holding the big rallies. So the reputation really goes back to the 70s.
In the Hall of Shame of America's Great Haters, the hypothetical Hall of Shame, where do you think Bob Miles stands?
He's at the very top. He's been dead for 25 years now, but he is still considered in that movement, in the KKK movement, the Nazis, the other white supremacist groups, he's considered one of the elder statesmen of that movement. If you go on YouTube today, you still see videos posted by some of those hate groups of Miles giving speeches and interviews.
So it doesn't take much to deduce that were he alive today, he would have been marching right down those streets in Charlottesville.
There's absolutely no question about that. And like I said, I cannot stress this enough, that the image that Howell has had to endure because of Bob Miles, he's been dead for 25 years, but it endures to this day. And every person who's ever lived in Howell or who lives in Howell now has had to deal with this unfair reputation. And you're always having to explain to people that that there is no Klan in Howell, there is no KKK in Howell. There really never was. All we had is one Klansman who lived about 15 miles outside of Howell, who held these rallies on his farm, and that's it. But everybody in Howell's had to deal with this reputation. You tell people that you're from Howell, or you have a friend who's an African American, and you invite them to come visit you, and they're afraid to come because they've heard of this reputation, and it's just not true.
I wonder, and I'm sure you spend time thinking about it, why such a persistent reputation? He died 25 years ago, and yet it's that reputation is still alive.
Yeah, and that's a great question, Cynthia. It really is because of what he did when he was alive was so visible, and with the cross burnings. And there was a documentary made on his farm in the late 80s called Blood in the Face. Michael Moore was actually part of the documentary crew that came out there that really helped to publicize and even glorify the things that were going on there. And that image is still, burned in people's memory. And it's sort of the type of thing that once that kind of a reputation starts, it's really hard to kill it because it's going to endure.
Buddy, how did people in Livingston County at the time who were opposed to what he stood for, how did they react? What did they do?
There was kind of that's a great question. There was kind of a transformation that took place because early on in the 70s and into the early 80s, I think the predominant feeling in Howell and in Livingston County was to just try to ignore him and ignore everything that he stood for. But an incident happened in 1988 that he actually didn't have anything to do with, but a cross was burned on the lawn of an African-American family that lived near Howell. And that really prompted the community to say, enough is enough. We need to not only tackle our image problem head on, but we need to tackle the whole idea of diversity in Livingston County head on. So a group was founded called Livingston 2001 that later became the Livingston Diversity Council, that was basically set up to talk about these issues and to embrace the idea that Livingston County needed to become a more diverse and more welcoming community. So they held a lot of programs in the schools. They did a lot of public awareness campaigns and really showed that Howell wasn't just going to sit back and take it, that they were going to fight back not only their reputation, but they were going to fight back on everything that Bob Miles stood for and to let the world know that this is not us.
Buddy Morehouse, former editor of the Livingston County Press in Howell, and these days he is a blogger for the Livingston Post. And Buddy, thank you so much for answering Zachary's question.
Great. Thank you, Cynthia.
And if you've got a question about Michigan, just go to the stateside page at michiganradio.org. There you can send us your question for consideration for our next round of Am I Curious? Disclosures show Quicken Loans upped its spending on lobbying and donating to politicians in 2017. Coming up, we look at Dan Gilbert's increased efforts in Lansing and what it may have gotten him. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's taken 25 years for the Illich family to realize their dreams for a shiny new home for the Detroit Red Wings. Little Caesars Arena officially opens tonight with a series of kid rock shows. The $823 million stadium will be the new home for the Detroit Red Wings and the Detroit Pistons. The public's share of this tab, so far, $324.1 million. Bill Shea of Crane's Detroit Business is here now to tell us how the Illiches were able to finance this new arena in a bankrupt city. And Bill, some might wonder what with bankruptcy, a crooked mayor now in federal prison for political corruption, a city that couldn't keep the streetlights on. How'd this deal get done?
I think all of those things sort of fed into that. It was the chaos. Detroit was so distracted by everything else going on and just trying to keep the lights on. Literally, the government didn't really have a whole lot of focus on this. And not that there was anything particularly nefarious going on, but, you know, everyone was looking at this project when it was unveiled, and they were like, you know, holy moly, you know, this is a huge, massive investment at a time of chaos and disaster in the city. So to some, especially elected leaders, sort of a beacon of light in the darkness.
Indeed, it was a beacon of light, right? I mean, there was really not a lot happening, especially in that area where the arena now is going to open its doors today.
Some argue that, you know, Olympia and the Illiches and those speculating about where the arena would go had bought up that land over 20-plus years, so nothing was built in that zone. I mean, very few American cities right next to their core downtown. But, you know, when this project was presented to everybody, it was, you know, like I said, excitement. It was a shiny new thing, and there was going to be a lot of private investment on top of, you know, some public money going into it as well. So that's, you know, and like you said, there wasn't a whole lot. I mean, there was some stuff going on, but, you know, nothing on this scale.
Mike Illich literally started thinking about a new home for the Red Wings pretty much from the moment he bought the team in 1982, right?
Yeah, that's true. You know, if you were ever inside Joe Louis Arena, it was not the most fan-friendly, team-friendly, or any friendly facility in, you know, sports or concerts. It was certainly allowed. The team certainly had a home field advantage in the sense of it was a loud, imposing place to play. But to get to it and to basically live and work there was an awful experience. So yeah, they were thinking and early on about they need a replacement for that. And by the early 90s, they really started putting that together.
But as you point out in your piece for Crane's Detroit Business, before he got down to breaking ground for Little Caesars Arena, he built a new home for his Tigers. And at that point, lenders were very leery about financing Comerica Park, but not for Little Caesars Arena. What was different?
If you think back into the 90s, I mean, certainly the Renaissance period hadn't begun for Detroit yet. And in pro sports, they were just on the cusp of the really enormous, gargantuan TV contracts that pump not just millions, but billions of dollars into pro sports. So that wasn't quite there yet. It was coming. And the Illiches also, you know, were having some trouble with the Little Caesars business. It was not nearly as healthy as it would come to be in the 2000s. Things got bad after Comerica Park was built, But, you know, Illich had to go to a consortium, I think it was 11 lenders, to get enough money for the private financing to build Comerica Park.
So here we are talking about Little Caesars Arena, and public money was a big part of getting Little Caesars Arena built. And all across the country, we are seeing more and more resistance to this idea of giving billionaires public money for stadiums and arenas. How did the Illiches handle this?
They assembled a team of experts, lawyers and, you know, lobbyists and things like that. And these folks all came together to craft this plan in Lansing, where they convinced the governor was on board from the start. And this was back in 2011 they began working on this. And they crafted a plan that would allow the Downtown Development Authority to keep on collecting the property taxes they have for years for economic development and expand that so that it could pay off construction bonds. And there was very little effective resistance to it. So they built the political wherewithal to get that done. And by this time, the Illich's business was doing so well and sports were doing so well with the TV contracts that the banks were ready to buy up that construction debt immediately. So it was much easier for them to finance this facility with public and private money versus Comerica in the 90s.
And they also made it more appealing by saying, look, we've got bigger plans for the area beyond just this arena.
Yeah, that's right. In the old days, up until the 1950s, sports venues were typically built by the team owners. And then that began to shift from the 50s on, and there was a lot of public dollars put in. But like you mentioned before, resistance has been growing. So what team owners, who generally now are almost always billionaires, the teams aren't their big money source. They have the financial capability to do more. So the trend for the past almost 20 years now has been saying, hey, we're not going to just build you an arena or a stadium. We're going to build a housing and office space, retail, big towers, entertainment, green spaces, basically almost like a city within a city concept. They've done that, I think, in Edmonton. Columbus did that for the Blue Jackets. And I think that makes them more palatable to a lot of people. You're not just getting an arena for the billionaire owner with some public subsidies, but you're getting people moving in and jobs and a growing tax base is the theory that they sell it on.
The Illiches made promises in securing this public money. Did they fulfill those promises?
So far, it looks like they have. They have some time to get things done, but they said they have built what they have said they were going to build, and they are attracting outside investors who want to come in and put in stores or restaurants or whatever, and they get criticism for taking public money that was basically offered to them. But they do have a lot of skin in the game themselves. I mean, their pizza headquarters they're building is $150 million, and they have some $500 or $600 million, into the arena project as well.
How about jobs and contracts for Detroiters and Detroit companies?
That's been part of the here and elsewhere, the community benefits agreements, where you say, we're going to build this, we're going to take some public money, and we're going to have, 51% of construction jobs will be Detroiters. And their contractors that they hired to build this agreed to that, and they've not all been able to meet that number. And that's a much deeper, longer story, because there's a real lack of skilled trades folks who are city residents. So, there's been some fines levied, and the contractors pay them in the form of skilled trades job training programs, which is a net benefit, I think, for the city. We need more carpenters and iron workers and things like that that are good, solid careers for Detroiters.
So back to the original point, Bill, if the city had not been slogging its way through a bankruptcy or the state through the Great Recession, would this arena be opening its doors today, do you think?
That's a real good question, because there are publicly financed sports stadia in cities that are doing very well. So it's possible, but I think if Detroit had its, was able to keep its eye in the ball and had a modern, sophisticated downtown development plan, they might have been able to extract more concessions, get more revenue for the city out of this type of deal.
Bill Shea, Crane's Detroit Business. Bill, thanks for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
2017 is shaping up to be a record year for spending by lobbyists and special interests in Michigan, money spent trying to influence Michigan lawmakers. And one of those with the deepest pockets, Dan Gilbert's Quicken Loans and Rock Ventures. Craig Mauger of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network has been digging into newly released campaign finance statements, as has Michigan Radio's Lansing reporter Shana Roth. They're both with us here now from Lansing. Craig, what do these new campaign finance statements tell us about just how much Quicken Loans and other Dan Gilbert entities spent on lobbying state government and donating to politicians in 2017?
Yeah, so it's very clear from these new reports that everyone has to file at the end of August or at the end of July that Quicken Loans and Rock Ventures, which is another Dan Gilbert entity, heavily increased their lobbying spending over the first 7 months of 2017. And at the same time, employees who work for either Quicken Loans or Rock Ventures have increased the number of campaign contributions they're handing out. So kind of the reach they're giving to a lot more state lawmakers than they had previously.
And is this because Dan Gilbert can't make donations to state politicians?
That could be part of it. But under Michigan law, Dan Gilbert and other individuals who have financial interest in casinos cannot give campaign contributions. That's been a longstanding state law. So while Mr. Gilbert is a major donor at the federal level, you should not be seeing any campaign contribution with Dan Gilbert's name on it in Michigan at the state level.
And this was the case, right? So we're talking about people associated with Rock Financial and Quicken Loans.
These contributions we're looking at tended to come from other executives in Quicken Loans and people who work in Quicken Loans' government affairs department. One, their state lobbyist, the person who's registered to lobby on their behalf, gave to 23 different state house members, for instance, over the first 7 months of the year. So it's primarily been executives and people who work in government affairs.
And to be clear, how does the rate of donating and spending on lobbying state government this year compare to previous years?
We looked at over 2016 and 2017. So those are the 2 years while these bills have been in the works to provide the tax incentives for projects that Quicken Loans and Dan Gilbert have in the works in Detroit. Over those 2 years, the year of 2016 and the first 7 months of 2017, they spent about $303,000 on lobbying. You compare that to the previous 10 years, Rock Ventures and Quicken Loans had only combined to spend $263,000 on lobbying. So you can see what an increase there's been. And the biggest year for lobbying, if you just look at 1 year, was 2017, the year we're currently in. The first 7 months of the year, about $156,000 Quicken Loans reported spending on lobbying, and that's more than they've spent in the last, all of the years that are on file with the Secretary of State for the public to see easily.
And Craig references these new tax incentive bills. And this spending was happening at the same time the legislature was doing a second pass at these bills to bring in new tax incentives. So remind us again, Shana, what is in these bills? Some call them the Brownfield bills. Others call them the Gilbert bills. What was in them?
Right. These bills are essentially major tax incentives for developers like Dan Gilbert's organizations that build on blighted or undesirable land. And we're not talking, a couple thousand extra dollars here or there. I mean, these are millions of dollars in tax incentives. And last year, before the end of session, the Senate had, pushed these bills through and they died in the House. They couldn't even get a vote in a House committee. And then first thing this past year, the bills were reintroduced in the Senate, and they actually went through much quicker. I think it was maybe about 3 months before they went from the Senate through final passage through the House and hit Governor Rick Snyder's desk. So it was a very, very different path that these bills took this past year.
And what do they allow to happen now? Now that they've been signed into law, what can developers do?
So what can happen is developers who want to take advantage of these incentives, and they have to meet very specific requirements as far as how many employees, where they're going to build, how many jobs they're going to create, things like that. They can apply for these incentives through a state agency, and then that state agency will make a decision of whether or not the project qualifies. The state agency says there's quite a few developers who have requested these incentives or have at least expressed an interest in taking advantage of these incentives. including Dan Gilbert's company. However, the spokesperson that I talked to said, you know, we can't really give you any specifics because we have agreed to a non-disclosure agreement with Dan Gilbert's company as far as, you know, what the specific developments are that he is looking to take advantage of. So we do know that within the few months that these bills have become law, that Dan Gilbert's company is pursuing them.
So we know that the bills, now law, allow for the capture of income tax revenue from the employees who work on these properties. And that certainly is a fit with Rock Ventures' plans for a $2.5 billion development on the site of the old downtown Hudson's.
And potentially, I think that $2.5 billion figure includes other potential developments in Detroit. And when you're talking about kind of that question that often gets asked, why should people care about this? I mean, this is not just a few thousand dollars. I mean, this is potentially hundreds of millions of dollars in incentives. There's language in here that allows for, you know, $40 million in reimbursements a year through the income tax capture that's going to happen in these bills. So, I mean, this is a large sum of money. The developers who support this bill would argue, these bills would argue that this is money that the state isn't currently getting, so the state's not really losing out on it. But this is development that they plan for the state, and this is revenue that would be coming to the state if this bill had not been passed.
Craig, were contributions given to lawmakers on both sides of the aisle?
Yeah, this was a completely a bipartisan venture. You know, they say nothing's bipartisan anymore, but this definitely was. You know, Democrats, a lot of Democrats got contributions from Quicken Loans connected donors, as did Republicans. I mean, I think we listed the six lawmakers in the House who received the most from Quicken Loans donors, and there were three Democrats and three Republicans. The vote on these bills was bipartisan as well. You had a large number of Democrats vote in favor and a large number of Republicans.
What was also interesting is it wasn't just bipartisan. It was also, I guess you could call it by vote. People who ended up voting no on the bills, there were eight of them who also received donations from Quicken Loans, including a small donation went to a Republican representative, Stephen Johnson, who spoke out quite adamantly against these bills.
Give us an idea what kind of donations, what amounts are we talking about here?
It depends on the lawmaker. I mean, we looked at 56 different House members who received contributions, and the contributions range from like $150, which is likely a ticket to a fundraiser, to a few thousand dollars. I think one lawmaker received $4,000 total across a few contributions from two or three Quicken Loans employees. So you're looking at a range from $4,000 to $150. And I think with this story, the amount isn't really what is something that we're focusing on, but the number of House members that got contributions. So like these Quicken Loans employees gave to 56 state House members over the first 7 months of the year. If you go back to previous years, Quicken Loans employees and the PAC, the last 4 years had never given to more than 13 state House members over an entire year. So there was kind of an explosion in the reach of the contributions.
And in previous years, it seemed like they were more focused on giving to the actual, like the party committee. So just like the Democratic House Committee or the Republican House Committee. Whereas this year, they really went to individual lawmakers, and over half of them received donations from Quicken Loans.
Now, Hudson's stopped all operations in that Woodward building in 1986. And you're talking to someone who grew up shopping at that glorious Hudson's on Woodward downtown. The building was imploded in October 98. And that site has just sat there for 19 years. So there are some who might say, well, if getting that tax incentive passed gets some development on that empty site, and Quicken Loans and Rock Financial made donations to lawmakers to make that come together, okay, so be it. Well, what do you say to that?
Yeah, there were a lot of lawmakers who made that exact same argument, that I have a property in my district that's not going to be developed unless these bills become law, and that's why I support it. It had nothing to do with the $500 contribution that I received. And I think that's an argument that definitely is something the public needs to hear. But I think it's also very important that the public knows the kind of lobbying and influence swaying that's going on as this much money is at stake. I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars potentially in public money at stake here. It's extremely important to know, like, what is going on with the public officials who are voting on this.
You can get the full report by going to mcfn.org, the Michigan Campaign Finance Network website. As we've talked to Craig Mauger of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network and Michigan Radio Lansing reporter Shana Roth, thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our engineer was Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.